commencing countdown. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ignition.
What an incredible smell, you scum!
Lord Jesus, this ain't happening, man. This can't be happening, man. This ain't happening.
Inconceivable!
Autobots, transform!
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show, episode number 27.
So nerdy it hurts. But in a good way, just like being groped at the airport.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Den.
And this week we have with us Joshua Gaylord, a.k.a. Alden Bell, author of The Reapers Are the Angels. This is interview take two, because somebody who shall remain nameless forgot to push record.
Duke!
It's lovely to be here, and it's good that we're redoing it, because... Oh. The last one was terrible.
Terrible.
Making me feel really good about myself. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Terrible. I was going to ask to redo it anyway, so it's...
thank you so much for coming back.
my pleasure.
Cool. So, to start things right off then, tell us about The Reapers Are the Angels.
Well, it's a post-apocalyptic zombie novel. And so it participates in that tradition, though its main character is actually a 15-year-old girl named Temple, who takes a road trip across the southern states. And so it's kind of half zombie apocalypse and half southern gothic. And she is being pursued on the one end, and she is in search of a home for her companion on the other end. And along the way, she kicks some zombie ass.
That's my favorite part.
That's the good stuff.
You mentioned the Southern Gothic. Can you explain a little bit more how the novel was informed by the Southern Gothic tradition? And can you point out some specific influences?
Oh, yeah. Well, in a later edition, I would love to do a kind of map of the Southern Gothic influences, because they are all over the place. Temple's name, even, is ripped off from William Faulkner's Sanctuary. The Grierson episode, where Temple comes across this household of people who are kind of trying to ignore the zombie apocalypse, that comes from Faulkner's A Rose for Emily. Emily's last name is Grierson. And it's all about the refusal to acknowledge the modern era and to kind of just live in the past. Temple's pseudonym that she uses, Sarah Mary Williams, is actually what Huck Finn calls himself when he dresses up as a girl and goes into town. Yeah, and it's like one thing after another. It's Faulkner is the main influence, but also kind of classic American literature like Huck Finn. Journey novel, and also Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God is actually where this book started, interestingly enough. And the term that I use for zombies, meat skins, interestingly enough, actually comes from Zora Neale Hurston, Their Eyes Were Watching God. She uses that term, not for zombies, obviously. There's no zombies in Their Eyes Were Watching God, but she uses it just to describe lowly humans. And so I ripped it off for my zombies. So it's really, it's loaded with Southern Gothic references. They're all over the place. So Faulkner, Zora Neale Hurston, Cormac McCarthy, though more Blood Meridian Cormac McCarthy than The Road Cormac McCarthy. Other people like Tom Franklin, Daniel Woodrell. All those books, I think, contributed to a certain degree.
Well, the way this book was initially thrown at me as a advanced reader, well, it wasn't an advanced reader copy, but it was for review, was they came to me and said this was a literary zombie novel. When I read it, I noticed one thing that is really prevalent, which is that this is a character-oriented story as opposed to what is more typical of these kinds of the popular genre, which this would generally fit into because it's a zombie novel. And so it's not plot-oriented like a more popular novel, but very character-oriented. So why did you sort of decide you wanted to avoid dealing with the plot and more with the characters? Because, I mean, there is a plot, but it's not the central point of the whole novel is specifically Temple, but even the characters she interacts with. So why go character-oriented?
Well, I tell you, the simple answer to that is that I don't really know how to write plot. You know, it's a flaw in me as a storyteller. I am so not interested in plot in the books that I read or the books that I write. The progression of events is very uninteresting to me. I'm really only interested in character and style. In fact, I'm more interested in style than I am even in character. For me, a book is all about style. I will read a book about anything with any events in it or no events in it and with any characters in it if I like the style. And so as a reader, I'm so style-based, and I think that's turned me into a style-based author, too. And of course, you know, some people at least want a little more plot out of the book. But I think as a writer, all you can do is really write the book that you would like to read yourself. And so, you know, for me, that's this book.
And you bring up the style, and in your case, you write this novel is in third person present, which is very interesting perspective considering the kind of world it's set in. So what was your sort of rationale for that, using present tense over another tense, or just in general, why you wanted the character to speak in that sort of way?
Right. You know, the present tense, a lot of people use the present tense because it provides a sense of immediacy, or at least that's what I always hear. That's what people say a lot. I don't even know that that's necessarily true. It seems to me that you could have a past tense novel that is just as immediate. But for me, what the present tense communicates is colloquialism. I think naturally when we tell a story, it sounds more colloquial to tell it in the present tense than in the past tense. You know, I mean, even if you tell a story, what you did today. So I go to the store and there's this person standing in line. You kind of naturally, in a colloquial sense, fall into a present tense mode. And so what I kind of wanted to do was to create this tension between a very colloquial and dialect sensibility versus, I think, also the other influence is this epic, almost biblical voice that is imposed over it. And so what I was trying to do is create this tension between those two voices, the colloquial and the epic.
Okay, so getting back to characters real quick, one of the things that we talked a little bit about last time and, you know, is fairly obvious in the novel is the fact that the actions of the characters are largely governed by self-determination. Temple actually literally, you know, seems to chafe at every chance she has for a more normal existence if it means that she can't determine her own future. She sabotages her chances with the first community by hanging out with men, even though she's warned against it. And then later, when she has a chance to go to California with Lee, where theoretically there's, you know, some sort of free state that's, you know, less attacked by the zombies, she turns that chance down as well. Was this a deliberate theme that you wanted to explore, or something that was born largely of the environment of the post-apocalyptic zombie world?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and it's, I think it has to do with the post-apocalyptic world and also the Southern Gothic world, both of which I think are fascinated by frontiers, these borderlines between culture and wilderness. And it's always very interesting to me to see these characters who navigate that borderline and even belong more in the wilderness than they do in society. And whenever they touch society, they don't quite fit. They, you know, like Temple has grown up in the wilderness. She's grown up in the wild in this post-apocalyptic zombie world. Other people have secreted themselves away in these little bastions of civilization, but Temple has existed out in the wild. and she's used to it, and she's become accustomed to it, and she certainly knows how to survive there. But what it also means is that she spent so much time in the wild, she can't really fit in the society. I think I'm always reminded of the end of The Searchers, that John Wayne movie. I don't know if you've seen it, but, you know, it's this Western. I mean, a lot of Westerns are about this, too. This idea that this man from the frontier enters society, and he's so savage, he can solve whatever problem you have with violence or brutality. But, I don't know if you remember the end of The Searchers, John Wayne gets to the doorstep. He's invited into the house. He gets to the doorstep, but he can't bring himself to go into the house. And all he can do is kind of turn around and go back out into the wilderness. And the implication, of course, is that he doesn't belong inside. He doesn't belong indoors. He doesn't belong in society. And I think the same is true of Temple. She not only doesn't want to be, she doesn't really belong there. And whenever she tries to fit into a society, the results are bumbling and or even downright dangerous. And I really, to me, it's really interesting as part of a study of the frontier.
Right. She is actually capable of navigating in those worlds, though, you know, in terms of the fact that she does allow herself to get dressed up in both situations where she's, you know, confronted with a matriarchal female figure. You know, she seems to crave, in some senses, the trappings of civilization, but she's unwilling to actually keep herself safe within those worlds. And all the other characters, I mean, not all the other characters necessarily, but a lot of the other characters seem to do the same thing. Moses, you know, definitely doesn't seem to quite fit in that first community that she encounters him in. And then you have individuals throughout that are, you know, out within that frontier. But they all seem to want the social construct with, or at least the safety of a social construct without the social construct itself, like the community.
Right. They visit it, right, exactly. And Temple even says she kind of likes that place, you know, the first place she visits. And she does like the trappings of it. And I think you're right. I mean, part of her wants to paint her fingernails that cotton candy pink. You know, there is part of her that wants to participate in all the traditional trappings of girlhood. But on the other hand, to me, that always seems like more of a temporary exploration for her. It's not entirely natural to her. She likes the idea, but it's almost like playing dress up for Halloween or something. She has no permanent inclinations in that direction, I don't think.
But meanwhile, because of their sort of self-determination, they have these very morally grounded or principled honor code, Moses and Temple particularly, that is, it's not at odds with each other necessarily. The code isn't at odds with each other, but it is what brings them into conflict with one another. And a lot of the other characters have their own self-determined, even if it is within a community, it is still somewhat free of what we normally would consider, you know, a typical moral code.
Right. It's certainly, they each have their own individual code of living, and Moses and Temple's codes, they overlap quite a bit. They're not entirely the same, but they do overlap quite a bit, and they're very much survivors' codes. They're very much frontiersmen's codes, and those codes are deeply, deeply important to each of them. And even if they don't make a lot of rational sense, one of the criticisms I get is from this book is from people who just kind of reject Moses' moral code, that he is going to kill the girl who killed his brother, no matter what, no matter whether his brother was trying to rape her or not. And that, as a code, is bothersome to a lot of people. But what I kind of like about Moses is that he acknowledges that it is kind of an unfair code, and that Temple is justified in doing what she did to his brother, and that his brother was a bad person and maybe even deserved to die. But nonetheless, the code states that you kill the person who kills your brother. And for Moses, if he doesn't have that code in this world that's gone completely to hell, you know, if he doesn't have that code, he has nothing. And so there is this, actually what I admire about both him and Temple, is that they have these codes that they are going to stick by to their deaths, no matter what. Because it's the only thing that they still possess.
One of the other things is, like you're saying, the roles, you have these very typical sort of survival frontier male roles. So, and one of the criticisms I heard is that you almost seem to be anti-feminist in your portrayal of the females. You have these fairly stereotypical female roles. Ruby, who is, I mean, she's largely positive, but she's rooted in a very clearly defined male-female society. Mrs. Grierson, who's maintaining her illusion of Southern gentility, and even seems to have, well, I suppose they're not slaves, but they essentially are. Mama, who's this grotesque, almost incestual matriarch of a clan. And then finally, the older Mexican woman who doesn't even speak English, but what Spanish I did translate, she seems to be obsessed with feeding the ghosts of her vengeful sons. And Temple, you know, who is the main character female, is as absolutely tomboyish as you can possibly make a female character, except for the fact that she, you know, paints her fingernails cotton candy pink. that's literally the only feminine thing that she seems to participate in. What would you have to say to that sort of criticism?
Yeah. That is an interesting criticism, and I was kind of fascinated by that when I read it. Well, first of all, Temple does have a traditional... She does have her own... Part of her femininity is her sexuality, and she does have a sexuality, and I wanted to make sure that we got to see that, and I think that's an important part of her. But, it's an interesting criticism, because I see the book as a deeply feminist novel. Although, you know, I think there is a certain kind of feminist perspective that suggests that it's only really feminism if you portray extremely non-traditional characters, which I don't know that that's necessarily the case. That seems to me a kind of two-dimensional kind of feminism. You know, one of the criticisms was that I gave the book over to a male voice at the end, and that subverted the female voice, or I guess, I don't know, oppressed it. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but they didn't like the fact that it ends on Moses' perspective. But for me, that was a real honor to Temple, and it actually reminds me, the more I think of it too, and I think I probably got this a little from Virginia Woolf, to The Lighthouse, which is a tremendous book, and it's all about the power of this Mrs. Ramsey character, who is this matriarch of this household, who holds everything together, and everyone's attention, all the gazes in the household are focused on her. And for the first half of the book, she's the center of the book, and then she dies. And the second half of the book, what's so powerful is you feel her power all the more through her absence. And for me, that's what the end of this book is about, too. The fact that, yes, it's given over to a male voice, but to show you, from an outside perspective, the power of Temple. That she really did have this impact on people. That it wasn't, you know, she's not just powerful because we're in her perspective the entire way through. She's powerful from the outside, too. And her loss is a huge loss, even to this brutal man who had been pursuing her and wanted to kill her. So, you know, it's for me the whole book is honoring Temple. And you're right, the other female characters are I guess kind of stereotypical feminine roles, but I think they all contrast to Temple, and Temple is the one who puts all those other roles to puts the lie to all those other roles.
Well, and it seems like those roles are necessary, because this is a world that it says on the book 25 years later, which isn't that far away from now, and you know, we've had hundreds of years of patriarchy, so it doesn't seem unreasonable for there to be people who are in their 40s or something, they would have been in their 20s now, to have still held on to these ideas of a past that no longer exists. And Temple, of course, is, she's born into the world. The world's already gone to crap by the time she comes into existence. So it seems like it's not that they're stereotypes, it's just these are the hangovers of a society that's built completely different than the one that we are now being presented with.
Right. I think that's a very good point, that a lot of these cultures that Temple enters into, where we see these, stereotypes of women, they're also cultures that are clinging to their own pasts and clinging to the stereotypes and the comforts of their own, of a culture that is now 25 years gone. But those, they cling to those cultures in the same way that Temple and Moses cling to their codes. And so it's not actually, I think that's a very good point. It's not surprising that they would want to maintain those certain roles, because it reminds them of a better era.
And I do think that when you talked about how Moses takes over, and the more I think about that, and the way that you talked about Temple and how it's sort of honoring her, it's almost, when I rethink about how Moses ends it, it's almost like an Olympic run, you know, where they have the torch run and Temple's running with the torch and then she dies. And it's almost as if Moses has picked up that torch. He may do something different with it, but there is, he doesn't just walk away from it as if that's the end. There's, he now is become sort of this guardian of the fellow she's been, who she's taken to this house and everything towards the end of the novel. He's sort of picked up her mantle.
Right. To me, it's I find it very beautiful, and honestly, I weep every time I read that ending, because I'm touched by the honor that Moses shows to Temple, and I think the fact that she, you know, the fact that she dies is very, not to give it away if you haven't read the book, but you know, I guess I
we just did. Ha ha.
Oh, I can delete that
there's
out.
There's a spoiler. Right?
I can delete that.
Right.
Don't. No, I have to admit, I cried like a baby.
I'm
totally willing to admit that.
I
think even my husband, who's kind of a manly man, not really, I'm just kidding, but I have a feeling even he got teary-eyed. And, you know, I asked him about the ending, and he was like, you know what, I was pissed. I was really, really, really pissed that that had to happen. But at the same time, I knew it had to happen that way. It only made sense that, you know, their moral codes and, you know, this would come to the conflict at the end. And you know, either way, one of them had to die. So.
Oh, that's nice. I think that's an ideal response. You know, I hated for it to happen, but I see how it had to happen. And, you know, honestly, too, I think a lot of people are upset about the way she dies. And the fact that it seems like it's a cheat somehow that Moses is cheated, that to die in such an arbitrary way seems very cruel. And I think it is cruel too. That's actually very much by design. I like the idea that there's this huge injustice at the end. That not only does she die, which is injustice enough, but that she dies at the hand of someone who doesn't deserve to kill her.
Yeah,
right.
And I really, you know, for me, I find that touching and kind of beautiful. And I know for other people it's very galling, because I've read the reviews that say that. But for me, it's very touching and beautiful and tragic. And tragic also for Moses, because he has this rage that he's almost infuriated by the fact that Temple had to die in this way. For him, it is a corruption of everything he's been working for. And it's just so, it's a real tragedy for him as well as obviously for Temple.
Yeah, well, I guess the one other major question about the novel that I had, because I know we talked about it before, but it sort of came up randomly, and I actually want to talk about it very specifically now. This issue of communication in your novel, of communication between, I mean, really anything, between people, between communities, between people and environment. I mean, there's this really interesting how you deal with communication in the novel. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, the ways you deal with communication and that sort of thing.
It's interesting. I haven't thought about that so much. Communication. What do you mean, like, between people? Between...
Well, I guess the one thing was what we had mentioned when I messed up and ruined the universe.
Specifically, I think you're referring to the fact that, you know, Temple can't seem to open up unless you can't communicate.
Oh, I see. Right.
I believe.
Yeah, that's right. One specific example. Yeah.
Right. There is that sense, right? I think that's very true. Is that she has many opportunities over the course of the book to communicate with people, and where she takes those opportunities and where she doesn't take those opportunities, I think, is very significant. It says a lot about her as a character and who she trusts and who she doesn't. You know, one of the small things, of course, is who she decides to give her real name to. Because some people and that's very much a sign of trust. If she gives her real name, if she says, "My name is Temple," that's an indication that she has found someone she trusts. And I think it's significant that she's always right. She never trusts anyone that she shouldn't trust. She's very good at reading people. So, you know, she has these opportunities to get close to people, and some of them she wants to get close to in a kind of purely physical way, and some of them she wants to get, you know, she wants to have with Moses, she has this kind of code, and they will talk about certain aspects of their past. Moses tells her stories from his past, and to a certain degree also, I think, storytelling and the revealing of your past and your identity is, in the book, a means of action. Now, Temple has one particular dramatic moment in the past which has informed everything she's done since that point, and that is something that she actually doesn't tell anyone in the book, except this old Mexican lady who doesn't understand English. And that's a very significant moment, too, because she reveals herself to this woman almost because this woman can't understand her. There's this. You know, I guess it's almost like talking to a shrink or something, or to someone who is not connected to you. Sometimes it's easier to speak to communicate the most dramatic things to somebody who is distant from you. And you can't get more distant than this woman who doesn't speak English. That part is actually ripped off from Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, where the main character, the kid, at the end of the book, comes upon this old, I think it's an old woman too, who is sitting there, and he begins to unload. It's the first time in the book we've really seen him unload his stories and tell where he's been and who he is, and he kind of rambles on this monologue for a long time, and then looks up at her where she's sitting and realizes that in fact she's just a corpse, and he's delivered this history of his own identity to a dead person, which I always thought was perfect and beautiful, right? That is exactly the appropriate confessor for this kind of frontiersman, you know, someone who can't respond.
Why then couldn't she tell Maury, who is the next best thing to a brick wall in some ways, you know? I mean,
yeah.
He doesn't talk back. He doesn't seem to understand, but she doesn't relate her story to him. And, I mean, I think she does tell him her name, I believe, but she never relates the story of her life to Maury, and he would have been just as good, theoretically, as...
Right. That's
so
a good
question. Why not him?
That's a good question. Right. She could have. No, that's a very interesting question. I think for me, she does not see him entirely as human. And I know that that sounds horrible, and the fact that she calls him a dummy throughout a large portion of the book has also rankled people. But, you know, it participates also in the Southern Gothic. It participates in the kind of character Temple is. Temple would certainly call him a dummy, and she would see him as a dummy. And she's a girl who has little patience for weakness. And so she, of course, from the beginning, she doesn't even really want to take care of him. And she tries as best she can to leave him to his fate. And he will be eaten by zombies. There's no question about it, because he can't defend himself at all. And she tries her best to do that, but she can't. You know, she feels like she has to take this responsibility upon herself. But for the entire book, she's trying to not to save him so much as to rid herself of this responsibility. And I think that's how she sees Maury. She sees him as an obligation, as a responsibility that she doesn't want to have. She would like to not have that responsibility. And so she never really sees him as someone to talk to, but it's more of, again, as terrible as it sounds, more of a pet than anything else.
But, I mean, on the same hand, though, she also seems to want the responsibility because she does keep him around, you know, regardless of the fact that he could theoretically have stayed with the Griersons. She still, you know, takes him along. And she could have abandoned him at any point in time. There were at least, you know, two situations where he would have been probably just fine. But she seems determined to see it through to that end, that inevitable end, instead of abandoning that responsibility. As right. if he's in some ways almost a replacement for the little boy that, you know, her sort of brother
right.
that died. Except that without the actual complete emotional attachment, more of just a responsibility attachment.
Right, right. I think there's, you know, that's really interesting too. I think probably for Temple, she does well. She wants the obligation and she doesn't. She feels for herself a desire to save him, but she doesn't want to feel that desire. It's kind of a classic traumatized person. You know, it's someone who's been emotionally traumatized. They don't want to go through the emotional trauma again, and so they are wary about getting close to people, but at the same time, of course, they want to get close to people, and they want to believe that this time it's not going to end in tragedy. And I think the same is true for Temple. She would love to believe that she could take someone, or that she could befriend someone again, that she could take someone under her wing, that she could form these relationships. Well, I think she would love to believe that, but I think she's been so hurt, and she's also gotten so used to being alone that she doesn't trust that those things will work out. And so she says, not just to Maury, but to other people throughout the course of the book, she says, specifically, I don't want to get that close to you because at some point you're going to die, and I don't want to be standing next to you when you die because I've already lost people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that to me, that's her psychological.
It almost seems like her relationship with Moses is actually like, it's like the perfect balance between having a person, but not being responsible for them. Having them as part of your narrative, but, you know, knowing that if they do die, well, that's just how it's supposed to work out anyway.
Exactly. I mean, that's why they're actually such a perfect couple, because he's someone that Temple can talk to, but she specifically does not have to worry about whether he dies because he's trying to kill her. And so, her responsibility towards him is nil. And that actually makes him a very comforting presence in her life, curiously enough. And I think a lot of those times where she's looking behind her to see if Moses is following her, it's, yes, with a certain amount of dread, but also with a certain amount of hope. She does kind of hope that he's still back there.
Exactly.
I like that.
That's right. What I thought, too.
Very nice.
All right, so our final question.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dun-dun-dun-dun.
It is, since you obviously have written a zombie novel now, what is your favorite zombie movie, comic, and or book?
Well, for me, it's all about Dawn of the Dead and the original George Romero Dawn of the Dead. I love that movie. I've seen it so many times. And, you know, it's the first time I saw it, I think I was 9 years old. My father took me to a drive-in theater to see it, and I was horrified and disgusted. And I was far too young for that movie. I don't recommend other 9-year-olds see that movie. But I was fascinated by it because specifically I loved how much of it did not have to do with zombies. And I loved the fact that so much of that movie was about, A, the relationships and personalities, and B, the logistics of recreating a world for yourself in a post-apocalyptic era. And I just remember how much time they spent on the nuances of locking the doors of that mall and making sure everything was locked and cleaning it up and setting up a new world for themselves. I remember being fascinated by this little home they made in a commercial center that was never meant to be a home. And to me, that was always much more interesting than the zombies themselves, who just seemed like more like a state of being. They weren't even so much a problem as they were simply a reflection of the world in which these characters had found themselves. And their ability to exist within this world seemed more interesting to me than their desire to fight against it. And I think for me, that's also what's really true about Temple, too, that what's interesting to me about her is not how she fights against the world, but how she actually manages to live in it in a very, for her, comfortable way.
Cool. Well, I guess the last thing is, what have you got coming up that we can look forward to?
Well, under my own name, Joshua Gaylord, that's the next book will be under my own name. And I just turned that manuscript into my editor, so hopefully she'll like it. But that is a book about 1975 Orange County. that's right. And it's about this aging beauty queen woman and a 12-year-old tomboy, again, and their desire to escape from a kind of suburban nightmare and travel to Las Vegas and Palm Springs together, even though they hate each other. For some reason, I tend to find myself writing a lot about women and girls. I think I have to figure out what that's about. but
I have to see a therapist.
Right? Women are just more interesting to me. I have no idea. I can't figure out, man. I've never been able to figure out.
I have to agree, but I might be slightly biased.
Right? Women are great.
Oh, sorry.
And then after that book, which I think will be called Frontierland, to continue the frontier motif that I am interested in, after that, the next book for Alden Bell will be a ghost book, a kind of a New York ghost book, where a contemporary thing, where I think my variation on it will be that all the characters will be ghosts. There will be no living people. Because I'm kind of tired of ghost books that are all about interactions between the living and the dead. So I just want a book that's just dead people and the culture that they create. And I like the idea of ghosts who just have no interest in communicating with living people, which I think if I were a ghost, that's the way I would feel. Why would I want to talk to living people? You know, I'm dead now. I've moved to a different place. So I like the idea of this world of ghosts that kind of intermingles with living people, but just have no interest in them whatsoever. So that will be, it's almost, I guess if The Reapers of the Angels is my Faulkner book, this would be my expat lost generation Hemingway ghost book.
Ooh, sounds intriguing.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming onto the show with us for the second time.
it was great again, and I look forward to next time that we do
Yay!
This.
Yay!
And next time will be after you've released a new book.
Terrific.
Well, thanks again, and we'll definitely put up a whole bunch of links so people can find your book.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
And we're back with our reading and writing section, so I'm going to go first because I just want to get it off my chest. Writing a paper on Derrida, I just finished the Shavira book I was reading, Connected, which was awful.
Because it was very disconnected.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Yeah, but blah, blah, blah. We're not going to go over it. It was just bad. It had a great idea. The structure was fascinating, but at the same time, it just failed miserably. I'm still reading the Kiernan book, Celine Kiernan's The Poison Throne, because we're interviewing her. Well, we already have interviewed her on Thursday, which is the Thursday previous to this one. But finishing that hopefully tonight, which would be Wednesday when we record this. And I finished the first book from Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Oh, how exciting.
I have the UK edition, so that's Philosopher's Stone.
Are you going to reread the whole series before?
Yeah, I'm going to try to, but I probably won't have time to finish them all before January. But yeah, so...
Is it coming out in January?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, the July is when the next half...
Oh, okay. God, you freaked me out.
All right, anyway, so what are you reading?
I actually just reread the first four ElfQuest graphic novels. I was first given them when I was like, I want to say like 9 years old, and I loved them, and I think I got most of my friends because of them and stuff like that. And now my girls are rereading them, and they're like obsessed with the ElfQuest series. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to sit down and I'm going to reread these. And they're still just as wonderful as they were when I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And it makes me very happy to read them. And unfortunately, the fifth book is stuck at my daughter's school right now, and it's making me very angry.
Well, that's depressing.
But that's what I'm reading. And I'm reading The Gunslinger by Stephen King as well, because Mia recommended it. And yeah, so that's what I'm reading.
Okay, well, what is our question of the week then?
Our question of the week relates to the fact that I just read the ElfQuest novels. What is your favorite science fiction or fantasy-based comic book or graphic novel? And when I say science fiction or fantasy-based, I do not mean mutants. So there, nothing, you know, like X-Men-y or Fantastic Four-y or whatnot.
That's ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous. I want... more pure science fiction or more pure fantasy, like the Books of Magic by Neil Gaiman years ago. That would be more fantasy. ElfQuest, more fantasy. More
Are we
science
throwing
fiction.
In horror as like, well?
Horror is also acceptable, but not your stereotypical mutant hero fantasy or science fiction.
Okay, well...
So that's the question.
All right. Well, they can send their answers the following ways. By email?
SkippyandFanty@gmail.com.
You could... send us a tweet, I guess. That would be a very short, complicated tweet, but okay, go for it. Tweet.
Twitter.com/SkippyandFanty.
Or you can leave a comment on our blog.
SkippyandFanty.wordpress.com.
Yeah, see how I did like the sexy our blog.
Blog.
Yeah.
Wow, chicka wow wow. Chicka wicka wicka. That's creepy. See you next
you
week.
You started
everybody.
It. See you next week.
Autobots, roll out!